99.5 from the campus of Seton Hall, and we are live. This morning, we're going to talk about in our first half hour of Quest Youth Radio, which is the best youth radio, the emergence of street art and graffiti. And joining us for our second half hour will be Uncle Ralph, the original, the only Ralph McDaniels from Video Music Box, one of the first video DJs to ever hit the scene, interviewing the likes of Nas, Tupac, you name it. Oh yeah, what's that billionaire's name? It'll come to me. You know who I'm talking about. Anyway, sit back, relax, don't you go anywhere. Keep it locked. Coming up in just a few moments, we're going to dive right on in. Everybody know my sweet baby bed. Wake up, everybody know my sweet baby bed. tuned to WSOU 89.5 from the campus of Seton Hall, and we are definitely live. Joining us here this morning is Mr. Tamir Davis, a graffiti artist himself. And we're going to talk about, diving right straight into it, the emergence of street art and graffiti. And who better to talk about such a subject than a graffiti artist himself? Now, I do have to admit, with all transparency, that I refer to him as the Black Librarian. But on his spare time, ladies and gentlemen, believe it or not, he is a graffiti artist. I don't know where he finds the time, but we're going to get him in here, and we're going to start chopping it up. So wait a minute. And good morning, Mr. Davis. How are you?
Good morning. How you doing, sir?
All right. I'm doing great. You know, the first lead-in song here, if you believe in yourself, you'll find a way. So my statement before I put you on was, how in the world do you find time to become a graffiti artist? I mean, with all the things, and I told the audience that you're a librarian as well, right? But first question, how do you find the time?
Well, to be quite honest with you, sir, I started graffiti when I was, like, in my teen years. I started out originally doing, you know, comic books, going to Saturday classes at Arts High School. And then when I actually attended Arts High School, and prior to going to Arts High School, a lot of people in the neighborhood, they was involved with graffiti. I recall Lakim Shabazz and the rapper and other rappers in the area actually going to my friend's house, Seven, the rapper. They would go over there and they would do break dancing and so on and so forth. And my mother was an artist as well, so I would see a lot of nice sketches, you know, character sketches, lettering sketches. And Seven's brother would actually show me a lot of graffiti. But that's how I got started. This is back in, like, maybe 84, 83, during that particular time, doing a lot of sketches in the classrooms, and then I would go to art classes at Louisville Spencer School this years back. But to talk about the emergence of graffiti, we can't talk about the emergence of graffiti and not talk about the impact of graffiti from Philadelphia. As mentioned on previous discussion we had, graffiti actually had emerged not from New York. A lot of people think it actually emerged from New York, but graffiti actually started during the 60s in the northern part of Philadelphia. It actually stemmed from the gangs at one point. There was a lot of gangs that was marking up territory, but then you had a person by the name of Darryl McCray and or Cornbread, who actually started graffiti in Brewerytown, north of Philadelphia.
So Cornbread is a nickname, right?
Cornbread is his tag name.
Okay.
Cornbread is his tag name.
Yeah, because you have to educate. You have to educate us who are not, you know, privy to the information and knowledge of street art and graffiti. So
yes.
Pardon our ignorance, and specifically mine.
So it would be like many people may call it a pseudonym, or in the street, that's what you would be identified for based on what you mark and in the territory and the areas that you mark. So a tag name for a writer is a person that tags. A writer can also be a person that do artwork too, or actually do what's called pieces and burners. And murals and what have you. So Cornbread was a tag name. Now what happens is in the 60s you had a lot of family, just like we had family that lived in down south in California. You had people that's from New York that actually would go, their children would go back and forth between New York, passing through New Jersey, going to Philadelphia. And they would see these tags, and they were fascinated by all these tags, gang tags and what have you, in Philadelphia. The thing that made Cornbread different is because of the fact that when Cornbread did his tags, he didn't represent any gang affiliation. He did the tag. He was probably one of the first taggers that did his tag representing himself, not a specific group. And so when Cornbread was tagging, he was tagging because of the fact that in the correctional facility that he had went to, the Youth Development Center in Philadelphia, he felt it was important to use the name Cornbread.
Okay, so I have to slow you down for a moment because you mentioned being incarcerated in the jail system. And, you know, a lot of people make reference to graffiti and street art as being something that, you know, basically being a criminal act, defacing public or private property. And so when we talk about the origins of graffiti and street art, what's going on here? You know, what is the history of street art?
Well, the history of street art is, if we go as far back as Kemet or Egypt, you would understand that people was actually writing on, they were writing in Pompeii. It was something that what people do. They would mark their territory. If you look into when Harriet Tubman was actually coming from the south to the north, there will be areas that will be marked and tagged to let you know which way to go up north. So that would, those will be with signals or alerts to be able to go up towards the northern region to reach that particular area. So, you know, tagging is very significant because it's a way of actually illustrating who you are, and most people just don't know you. You know, the thing is to be able to do your tag, and a lot of people don't really know who you are because it was the enigma. You know, it was the enigma that was very important in terms of tagging. You know, it's a secret society, if you will.
Okay.
I
do have to agree with that 100%. But my next question is off the script, and I kind of mentioned it to you. How on earth do these graffiti artists get to the most difficult places to do their artwork and tagging? I mean, like, you know, we can talk about tagging the New York City trains, but on top of buildings on the corner, and you wonder, you know, is there a specific name for graffiti artists that seem to defy the acts and laws of gravity?
Well, no, it's about, the most important thing is to get it right.
Okay.
That's the name of the game. It's to get a rep. And once you get a rep, then now you're known.
Okay.
That's the most important part of graffiti. A lot of people forget that it's about, a lot of people on the outside forget that it's about getting rep. But not only that, it's only also about your territory. So you can't think that when it comes to graffiti and the emergence of graffiti and the impact of graffiti on the trains, it was about the train line. So if you was about the 1, 2, 3 line, that was your particular area in your neighborhood. So for other people that's not a part of that area and that neighborhood, and they did not get permission to be on that train line, you had a problem if you got caught in the train line because that's not your area. The only way that you can go to that train line if you was associated with somebody from that train line, what have you. So you had different groups, the Ball Busters and different gangs, and then you had to look at the fact that during the emergence of graffiti was also gangs simultaneously. So people that were part of a graffiti crew was affiliated in some instances with a gang.
Okay. So,
because that was protection as well.
Right. So we talked about at the beginning how the origins of street art and graffiti grew out of Philadelphia on the north side. And you gave us the history of street art itself going back to Kemet, and you went back deep into Pompeii, right? And then, of course, I had to ask about the defying acts of gravity with graffiti artists. And the history of graffiti art in the U.S. Are we to believe that this is something that sparked out of Philadelphia into New York and no place else was tagging and doing this type of thing until
it... What I would say is that if I'm saying that this goes far back as Pimpay, I'm saying that it goes far back as Kemet, so that means that there were people tagging and marking their name in Rome and other places too.
Okay, so now, when did the tell us the story about how graffiti meets modern art and how that begins, you know, because at one point this thing is against the law, you know, and then now today it's seen as modern art, street art. Talk to me.
Well, the thing is that we talked about Ed Koch and his efforts, 77, 76. You had other different mayors prior to Mayor Koch, Lindsay, Jonathan Lindsay, another mayor that was actually put out a $20 million initiative to actually erase all the trains during that particular time during the 70s. Now, we have tourists coming from all over the world looking at New York as a tourist site. And when they come in, they see all of these artfully designed trains taking place, right? Going all, you know, people coming all over the country. So New York is a very important tourist site. So while they were, they had this war to tear it down, then there were people from Germany and France and Paris that was taking pictures of these particular trains and looking at these young people as affluent artists. Now you have back in 80s, you had art books coming out, graffiti art books, so they are, by Henry Chapin, art book coming out by Martha Cooper that actually depicted the artist as artists, right? Which gave the opportunity for a lot of these artists who wasn't actually being reverenced in the United States of America, they were able to fly over to Europe to sell their artwork for astronomical amounts of money, become part of major art shows, to actually live affluently in places because they respected the art and they respected them as artists. So then fast forward, that becomes part of the culture. Now, let's look at Rockaware. Let's look at Sean John Clothing. Let's look at all these clothing lines. Most of the artists that was designing this stuff were graffiti artists, making a hell of a lot of money designing these clothing lines. If you look at major movies, you don't see major movies or major sets. I know artists that were graffiti artists that work for Netflix and movie sets. So the graffiti is a driving dynamic of our culture, whether people like it or not.
Well, I think people like it. The emergence of street art today is something that we see every place, and it's accepted as a regular art form in regular society where it originally came from the streets.
Yeah, it was something that, and then you got to realize the fact that during the 70s, a lot of the art programs and music programs in New York City and many of the cities throughout urban America, artists were getting, art teachers were getting laid off, music teachers were getting laid off. So those programs wasn't something that was fostered to urban kids and urban communities.
Right.
So
the disconnect.
There was a great disconnect. So you had artists that had to learn on their own. And so it was me passing down information to the next guy. So they had to do what they had to do. Most of the art programs were cut. I mean, in 1977, there was a major blackout in New York where looting had taken place because there was a scarcity all over New York. During that blackout, there was a lot of looting. There's a lot of people still, a turntable still to this day costs about maybe $1,500. They were able to ascertain a lot of this stuff That's when you had the emergence of DJs and people having spray paint and all this other type of stuff back in Blackout 1977.
Okay.
So
go ahead.
So we're talking about that scarcity. We're talking about the economic depression, if you will. We're talking about people not having access to certain things, the time of financial, basic nourishments and food. So it was an intense situation. It was an intense situation.
So, you know, when we talk about, and thank you for highlighting that, I just want to put an asterisk next to it. So when you talk about coming from the street, you talk about a genre, mm-hmm. art form, where people made something out of nothing. We talk about hip hop. We talk about graffiti, and this is where we are today, where something from nothing is now accepted around the world. Any last words or anything that we might have missed? Because you pretty much, you know, describe the emergence of street art and graffiti and how it came about. What are we missing? Oh,
you know what? Here's the thing. Now they're realizing there's no difference between street art and art, because art is art. That's where it needs to go. And that's where we're going now. Today, right now, in Newark, in the Ironbound section, there's certain areas where you have people painting muralists all over, great murals. People flying in from all over different parts of the world to paint murals. This happens every year. On September 29th, on September 30th, we're having an art show in Mount Clair in Dufunk Magazine, in which I'm at the helm at, and a great friend, graffiti artist, and I, sent. PFE, we're doing a great art show. There's another art show that I'm doing. So many different things taking place. It shouldn't be street art. In my sense, I think it's disrespectful to call it street art.
Okay,
it's just
so
art.
So now, you know, we're talking about a movement. Talk about the graffiti movement, and you just highlighted us about events that are going on.
Yeah, so what happens is, we was doing this to let them know that this is what we do, and we're going to continue to do it and have it become part of the mainstream culture, whether you like it or not. Because, look, when we look at the record companies, in the beginning, like the first hip-hop record, since we're talking about the first of the history of hip-hop, the first hip-hop record wasn't the Sugar Hill Gang record. It was actually King Tim III. That was the first hip-hop record that came out 6 months before the Sugar Hill Gang record. That was the first record that actually came out. But what happened is things began to get overlooked. We've been doing this for eons and eons. We've been rhyming and rapping for, this is something that we do. When we talk about rapping, you can't neglect the fact that we've been toasting. So rapping came out of the toasting that we used to do. And we would sit back and become very braggadocious and use words and rank each other out, and at the same time, without killing each other.
Okay.
It was a words war, and that was still your man at the end of the day.
Right, right. I'm going to wrap the interview up. What are the last words that you have to share about street art, graffiti, and this particular interview that's taking place right now?
Well, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm not going to stop because I'm an artist.
Oh.
And anybody that I'm around, that's what they do. I'm encouraging to keep creating your artwork because you're not killing nobody. You're not selling drugs. You're not doing anything to hurt anybody. This is my therapy. Like I told you one time before, when I'm on this radio show, this is therapy for me. Doing the artwork is therapeutic. I don't have to worry about getting the charge or doing something crazy because it keeps my mind occupied.
Okay, so I'm going to let you go because I know we have another interview coming up where we're going to be talking about the evolution of interviews and the original VJ Uncle Ralph McDaniels. Mr. Davis, I want to thank you so much, and we're going to continue our program, and I'll talk to you on the other side. And you have a blessed and great day, and again, thank you very much. Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Uncle Ralph, Mr. Ralph McDaniels. Good morning, Ralph. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, brother. What's going on, man?
Oh, man. Well, you know, I've been announcing you as one of the original VJs to ever hit the scene this morning. So when I say that, am I correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to start out, you know, because I got a title for the interview, but I have like a jazz background. Jazz is in my soul. And so I was reminded yesterday when I was talking about you and this particular interview that 103 years ago, this is what I was reminded, 103 years ago, blues was born And blues was something that told the story, a story that no one wanted to really hear, about a people that were trying, society was trying to ignore. And I was told, well, you know what? Blues is basically, well, hip-hop is the great-great-grandchild of the blues, because it kind of does the same thing. Talk to me. Absolutely.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I have a documentary that's on Showtime right now. It's called You're Watching Video Music Box, and it's directed by Nas. And in my archives of, you know, thousands of hours of videos, I interviewed Dizzy Gillespie. And don't ask me why. And people say, well, why were you interviewing Dizzy Gillespie? Well, that's a whole nother story. But in that interview, I asked Dizzy Gillespie about hip-hop. And he said he loves it. You know, and I said, well, what do you find about it that's interesting? He says they treat hip-hop in the beginning just like they treated jazz. They Negro music, he didn't say Negro, he said the N-word. Nas looked at the interview and he was like, whoa, I never heard Dizzy Gillespie say that. I said, yeah, this has been going on for a long time, brother.
Yeah. So it's interesting, you know, somebody compared me to you, because I've been doing this radio thing for over 35 years. This is not about me right now. This is about you. Could you share with us how you initially got involved in the world of hip hop and the music production scene and video?
Well, I started out as a DJ out of high school, and that was in 76. And this was like in the disco era, you know?
Right.
And we were playing disco records and R&B records, and we would play between bands. You know, now you got DJs who play, you know, like, you know, the Funkmaster Flexes and all of them, and Kid Capri's and all of those guys, they play a whole night. But back in the days, you would play in between a band. Okay. So you might have Kool and the Gang playing, and then Kool and the Gang would take a break, and then the DJ would come on for a half an hour and play music. And that's when I started out at. And, you know, we'd get, you know, if we got $50, that was a lot of money. And so, you know, so I started out in those days, and then eventually it transitioned to just the DJ to play the whole night, because it was less expensive. The promoters would say, hey, I could give this guy $50. I don't have to pay the band $200. And so I started out at that time. And then I went to college in Long Island, and I got into TV and film. And that was the transition into a whole nother space that, you know, up to that point, I had just been looking at TV from my house. Now I was behind the scenes and understanding how TV shows were made. You know, I did camera work, and I did engineering and all of that stuff, the technical side of TV. And I got a job working at a TV station. For people that are listening, they know Channel 31 back in the days. And I saw, you know, real people working there. And there was a brother there and said, you know, you can work with us when you graduate from college. And when I graduated, they, you know, they said, okay, you got a job. And I started there. And then I came up with this idea maybe a year later, because all the shows were not geared to where I grew up at, you know, in my community. I lived in Brooklyn at the time. And I said, man, we need a show for us. And I started the music thing.
Right. So I just got finished talking about graffiti and street art and the whole idea with Tamir Davis. And we were talking about the whole idea of making something out of nothing, coming from the streets. And with an educational background, we can't say you really came from the streets. But, you know, it's hard for us in the society that we live in to avoid it. We have to try to trudge by it. And so you basically went into the second question. How did you envision the impact on the hip-hop scene when you were putting together Video Music Box?
Well, I treated it, and I still today sometimes treat it like the DJ. it was like you have an opportunity to play, and that in the case of Video Music Box, play music videos that people really haven't seen before, because music video wasn't a thing yet. If you had MTV, you had to have money, and MTV was not everywhere. You didn't have cable television back then.
Hey, wait a minute. I'm going to interrupt you. MTV, because I have to say this. MTV wouldn't even play Michael Jackson. They didn't play black videos.
Exactly.
Excuse me. I told the truth. I told the truth. Oh, yeah. I interrupted you. I just had to say that. I interrupted you, but please, if you can pick up where you left off.
Yeah, so, you know, I was playing, you know, music videos of not just hip-hop artists, just African-American artists, or music videos that I thought we liked, you know.
There
so
you go.
Like Hall & Oates, you know.
Right.
And, you know, and certain things like that, you know, I felt like I heard on the radio back then, you know, or I was just familiar with as a DJ playing music. And so that caught the attention of the public just by word of mouth. People kind of stumbled across this channel, and you had to have your antenna set up. That's when you had an antenna on your TV. you had to have the antenna, you know, if it was cloudy, it might not come in clear. You know?
Yeah, amazingly, young people, when I try to tell them about this thing, they look at me kind of strange, and I'm like, okay, but you do like hip-hop, though. Yeah, okay, but you know nothing about the history. Okay, so now throughout your career, you've interviewed numerous of iconic hip-hop artists. Now, can you recall a particularly memorable, unexpected moment from one of those interviews?
Wow. From hip hop, I think for me, because I was born in Brooklyn, and then I moved to Queens. So Run-DMC became a big deal for us. You know, they literally lived down the block from me in Hollis, Queens. And so, you know, they were these kids. They were a little bit younger than me, but I knew that you know their brother Russell Simmons, because I did parties with him. He was a party promoter. That's how he started. So to get Run-DMC on the show was a big deal, because it meant something to the community where I grew up at, you know, and they kind of blew up fast, you know. And so I remember going to Jamaica Park in Jamaica, Queens, and that's where we used to go to play basketball, and Run-DMC did the same thing, you know, and we sat down and we did a whole interview, and that was one of the first times you saw, you know, Run-DMC, you know, talking, you know, and having a conversation outside of, you know, like entertainment.
Yeah. Okay, so now, how do you think the role of music producer and interviewer has evolved over the years, considering the changing landscape of the music industry?
Well, I'm not really a music producer, but you know, we used to go, I mean, I just know from covering it, is that, you know, we would go into a studio, and that studio was probably somewhere where rock and roll bands used to, record their music, and then we would sit there, and, you know, the band would come in, or the group would come in, and you sit down, and you have a conversation with them, and they'd be in there for hours and hours and hours. You know, nowadays, these kids record music in their house. You know, and it's all digital, and you can do it over and over again and get it pretty quickly and master everything and for a fraction of the cost. Or you would have to bring in a bass player, or you'd have to bring in a drummer. Now you can do all of that on your computer.
Okay, yeah, and that is so true. And a few weeks back, we talked about artificial intelligence and how that's going to be making a scene on society right now. What do you believe that are the key elements that have contributed to your longevity and success in this, in your genre?
Yeah, I think for me, you know, one of the things that I always wanted to do was have community affairs in the show and use that to kind of transition to music. As a kid, I listened to Gary Bird on the radio, and because he was like my age or maybe a little bit older than me, but I could relate to it. I felt like he was talking to me on a station called WWRL, really, in the beginning.
Right.
And he would do the overnight, and I would have my little radio in the bed. You know, I'm supposed to be going to school, going to sleep, but I have and I'd listen to him, and he'd talk about things that were going on in Harlem, or things that were going on in Brooklyn, and things that were going on in, across the world, and then he would transition into a Stevie Wonder song, or Earth, Wind & Fire song, or, a Kool & the Gang song, and I was like, man, he did that real smooth, and I want to do it like that, the conversation is related to the song. There's a name for it. I can't remember what they call that, but yeah, that was something that was super important, and so I went out with my camera, not only just interviewing the artists, but I was in Brooklyn with Sonny Carson talking about the African burial grounds, and I was in Harlem, at Harlem Week, and just getting the feel of the community that I grew up in, that I walked through at those particular times.
Yeah, and that puts it in proper perspective. Can you tell us about an artist or interview that has had a profound impact on your own perspective on hip hop and its culture? I don't know if that question sounds redundant from the other one.
Right. Well, no, I think that Public Enemy. So I worked with Public Enemy in the early stages. That's when I started making music videos as a director and a producer of music videos. And so I went to Roosevelt, Long Island, and just hung out with them, in their studio, and where they did, all of their stuff and came up with ideas, and Chuck and Flavor and the Bomb Squad and Bill Stephanie and all these guys. They had a whole little movement in Roosevelt, Long Island, which was not too far from Queens. And so I was familiar with the area. And I watched them come up with ideas and then transition into it to a record deal with Def Jam Records. And it was powerful, like I could relate to what Chuck was saying. I could relate to the hecticness of the sampling that the Bomb Squad was doing, because they were just chopping music up, and somehow or another it became a song. It was like the soundtrack of my life at the time and many others. And the impact was powerful. It reminded me of Malcolm X and Black Panthers and everything that was going on that I grew up as a young kid. It just felt like that. So I thought that was powerful.
Wow. This particular program talks about the representation in the media and how the African-American diaspora is not always depicted or represented. And that is one of the reasons why we're here at WSOU at Seton Hall. I just want to throw that out there for you, brother. But with the rise of digital media and social platforms, how do you think platforms like Video Music Box compare to the ways artists engage with their audiences today?
It's a lot different. There wasn't as much competition as there is now.
Right.
First of all, you got social media platforms that suck up everything.
Everybody's a star.
Exactly, right. Everybody's a star. So, if you're creating something now, you have to compete with that, or you have to at least be mindful of it. I don't know if you have to compete with it. So you use certain tactics, maybe that they use or that are used on social media, or certain terms that maybe, because you want to be in tune with what's happening. I think that's the word. You have to be in tune with what's happening. And you have to be informative. You know, that's another thing. Like, a lot of young people come up to me and want to do a TV show or, you know, have an idea. And I'm like, well, it's not about me or you. It's about what you're putting on the screen.
Right.
You know, people have to be able to relate to what they're hearing or watching. And then you have to keep them there, you know. And we were commercial free, so I would be like, you know, transitioning to one thing to the next, one thing to the next, and next thing you know, an hour went by, and they'd be like, I'm gonna sit here for a whole hour watching this thing. I didn't even realize that an hour went by, but that's the magic of a DJ. You know, a DJ won't keep you on the dance floor for all night long, you know, and so he transitions creatively and smoothly and cutting and scratching and whatever it is that he does or she does, and that's how we keep you engaged.
Yeah, well, now, over the years, hip-hop has evolved and diversified. How do you adapt your approach to interviewing artists from different sub-genres within hip-hop?
Yeah, you know, I remember when we first started, well, not when we first started, but as hip-hop started to evolve, you know, you would have different artists. And I can, there's an artist from New Jersey. He was down with Naughty by Nature. Oh, man, I wish I could remember his name right this second.
What?
But
not Tretch, but his...
No, a white kid.
Oh, okay.
And because he kind of came out of that world, which I was familiar with by that time, you know, a lot of creative artists, a lot of different artists, you know, and the producers that were making his music, I was familiar with them, so it sounded like, you know, the 90s, it sounded like something that, you know, Tretch could have been rapping on, you know, something Bone is his name, I can't, Milkbone, and Milkbone was dope, you know. It's almost like, you know, you were like, if you didn't know, you were like, this sounds like a brother, you know, rapping, you know. And he was dope, and he, you know, and he's still around, you know, to my knowledge, a couple of years ago since I spoke to him, but to my knowledge, he's still around. And he had success because the black DJs played him, you know, the hip-hop DJs played him, you know, and because he came from that culture, or the music sounded like that. Now, in some cases, that's not the case, you know. There was a big controversy. Now I think it's over. Where Melly Mel didn't think Eminem was that good, you know. And he said the only reason why he got the recognition because he was white, and everybody went up in arms. And I understood what Melly Mel was trying to say. I think that Eminem is good, but I do think that I understood where Melly Mel was coming from. You know, we embrace all of these things, and it not just music, all of these products and all of these things that come through our radio stations and our TV stations, and we don't even know who these people are. You know, some of them are not here for us. You
right.
know, they're taking their money and they're going somewhere else. And Melly Mel's point was, look, man, when this is all and over and Eminem don't have a record out, he's going back to his community. And he ain't thinking about the black community. He says, I have no choice but to think about the black community. I'm black. I have to be there all the time. I have to go through the hood. And I said, I got you. I said, well, that's a whole nother conversation.
Right. Now, could you share any insights into the process of selecting artists to feature on Video Music Box and the criteria that you use to highlight these emerging, this emerging talent that was coming through the doorway?
It was just like just like a DJ. You know, I'd listen to it. I listened to the beat. I listened to the vocals. You know what they were saying, the lyricists. You know, some were better than others, but they might have a good beat. I'm like, the beat is hot, man. I'm gonna have to play this. Or the beat wasn't that good, but they had something to say. And in the case of a video, you know, the video really looked good. You know, like they just did some creative things that we'd never seen before in a music video. You know, I used to play this video on my show. It's actually an intro video, Music Box, and it's not a hip-hop video. But it's a song called by a group called A-ha, Take On Me. And creatively, it was amazing. you know, I'd never seen a video that looked like that. You know, it used animation, and it was really on time, and you know, it wasn't a rock and roll song. It was like a new wave type of song, but we played new wave music because it reminded me of house music or club music, you know. And some of it was a little bit more soulful than others, you know. Like we used to go to the Zanzibar in Newark, New Jersey, all the time, you know, and other clubs, and we'd hear different sounds coming out of there, and that was in, you know, in the late 80s or in the mid 80s, and the kids looked like hip-hop kids, but when you listen to the music they were playing, it wasn't hip-hop. It was danceable, you know, R&B or danceable spoken word.
Right, like club, yeah. From your vantage point, what do you see as the most significant challenges and opportunities for up-and-coming hip-hop artists in today's music industry?
Oh, it's wide open right now because, you know, opportunity, because hip-hop is pop music, opportunities that weren't available in the 80s and in the early 90s were just regular things. You know, it ain't nothing to hear, you know, a hip-hop song in the Popeyes commercial, or, you know. That didn't happen back then, you know. That was commercial world. That was commercial mind.
Yeah. Well, are there any interviews that stand out to you as having had a lasting impact on the hip-hop culture or even on your own personal outlook?
I think for me, and I always tell this story, and this is not a hip-hop artist, but I interviewed Patrice Rushen.
Mm.
So Patrice Rushen used as jazz artist, right? But in the 80s, she made some commercial records, you know, Forget Me Not,
right?
Haven't You Heard, and those records were sampled by hip-hop artists. Will Smith sampled it. Many of her songs were sampled in from that era of Patrice Rushen.
A lot of people just don't know how talented Patrice Rushen really is.
Right. I didn't know at the time. I'm just thinking I'm going to interview R&B singer. And when she started talking, I realized I'm way over my head. This woman is smart as heck.
Yeah.
And I was like, it was intimidating. You know, I was like, okay, let me get my vocabulary together, first of all.
Yeah, because, you know, this is about you, not Patrice Rushen, but a lot of people don't know that she is a producer extraordinaire, all right? I'll just say that. But wait a minute. So last question, kind of, right? How do you see the future of hip-hop and the music media evolving, and how do you hope to continue contributing to its growth and its preservation?
Well, hip-hop music and young people, hip-hop to me is a young people's music, right? So
right.
Often I hear people say, oh, I don't like the way it sounds. It's not how it used to be. But, you know, this is the transition. I like to let the process go through whatever it is. Sometimes we might go through some times where we don't really agree with what the sound is. But, and hip-hop has always been abbreviated, you know, like we abbreviate a record, you know, like you don't, Kool Herc didn't play the whole record, he played just the break part. Now we just hear lyrics and we don't even understand what they're saying, but the kids know what they're saying.
Right.
So it's constantly being abbreviated and shortened and done and manipulated in whatever way. So we're in an era right now that, you know, sometimes I'm listening, I don't know what that person just said, but clearly this 10,000 or millions of kids that do know what he said.
They getting it.
And, right. And that's okay. So we have ability to reach a whole lot of people in a short amount of time. And I think that is still open to, and we are independent. We don't have to go through record companies anymore.
Okay.
Now, getting played on major radio stations might be a different story, but we don't have to go through. We can make those records, we can put them on the internet, and millions of kids can hear it right away.
Last words, Mr. McDaniels, thank you so much. Last words from you, anything you want to shout out, say, give it to us.
Yeah, man. You know, look, we have a nonprofit that we started a couple years ago, and it's called the VideoMusicBoxCollection.org. It's 20,000 hours of all of this stuff that we've been talking about for the last couple of minutes.
Right.
And, you know, and we want to make sure that it's available to, you know, learning institutions like museums and libraries and colleges, and so that young people can go back and take a look at, you know, that Run DMC interview or that Patrice Rushen interview, or just see the way people dressed and the swag, or what New York looked like, or what New Jersey looked like, you know, back in 83 or 84. And so it's a collection, it's a historic collection, and we hope people will be involved in it and support it from our community, because that's really what I'm doing it for, is, you know, for our community and people who love hip-hop, and, you know, and that people can enjoy something that's historical. So it's the Video Music Box Collection.org.
All right. Thank you. We want to thank you again. We are, you know, better known as Quest Community Vibrations, Quest Youth Radio, which is the best youth radio. Mr. McDaniels, thank you so much for getting up so early on this Saturday morning. Enjoy your weekend, and God bless you for being with us and being who you are to contribute to the industry, the music, to the culture, hip-hop, and everything. Thank you again.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for having me.
Self-determination.
I used to build things up from the bottom. Used to be like a man out of something. Grabbing all the scraps that's from the garbage. Make a masterpiece on the people wanting.
I started from the mill, down the hill, from a landfill. Only had skill to stand on, yet at a standstill. Funky like the band Mandrill. Underground, always busy like an anthill. Couldn't wait to truly be on the case like an anvil. To the rejection letters, messing with my head like an Advil. I wasn't the one with a six.